Savvy regards once again to the staff of student teachers at Nemata. This is the main professor recording in the early hours of the morning, October 3rd, 2019. The title of this unit, Talk and Text, comes from an old song, well-known song, from Carlos Santana. And that would be, of course, Black Magic Woman. Now, as you know, that meme is somewhat misleading. I can certainly affirm that the magic of the Aeonic Mother comes in a spectrum of colors, from white to black, and including quite a few shades in between. So, no need to get fixated on the negative connotations of that particular meme. I'm just using it to lead into the subject here. I'm just invoking it to set up as the setup for my reflections on the Charlotte working. Of course, superficially speaking, black magic means something bad, something evil, something that good people don't do. And certainly, the use of magic spells to kill would be included in that category by most ordinary people around the world, I would say. But of course, in the case of the Charlotte working, there is a huge question in play. And that is the question of the application of black magic / killing magic through the dreaming power of the Aeon Sophia. I don't have to tell anyone that the Aeon Sophia holds all the threads of life constantly in her hands, if you want to imagine she has hands. She holds all the threads of life and all the threads of death, and constantly weaves on her tapestry the symbiosis of life on this planet. Is a continual interplay of life and death. The rotting of insects, the death of dragonflies, and the rotting of their bodies into the soil, the rotting of human bodies into the soil, the regeneration of the soil. It's a continual process of black magic, her killing power. So, I am going to assume that all of you are comfortable with this black magic meme due to putting it in the framework of planetary tantra and dissociating it from the usual cheap connotations of conventional thinking and superstition. Now you'll see that I've taken the liberty to glamorize this unit with some quite remarkable images, kicking off with the two women. I believe they would be Zapotec Indian, Mexican Indians, decorated for the Day of the Dead celebration, which is a really big folk festival in Mexico. And that festival, of course, coincides with the Celtic festival of the Samhain, is that it? And All Souls Night and other European festivals of the native European peoples, which has been vulgarly turned into Halloween. And of course, that festival represents evidence of the acceptance of death by indigenous peoples and the necessity that they feel to remind themselves of it as a supernatural aspect of life, something that is unknown, because no matter what you may think happens, you don't really know what happens at the moment of death. Well, there are many reliable reports, actually, but it's a fundamental unknown for people. And whereas religions attempt to give an explanation on faith, or by fabricating an explanation of what happens after death, the more courageous and honest way to face it is in the way it has been done. And the festival of celebration of death is a recognition of its power, of its presence, but at the same time, recognition that it is something that can be benevolent as well as malevolent. Death appears in the human world as a natural process. And I venture to say that one would be an extremely lucky person today, an extremely lucky tad, if you conclude your life by dying what is called a natural death. In any case, death comes, and then there is the death that is inflicted by human animals. And these are two different realms of action, two different realms of action. So what you see in the faces of these women, what do you see? What do you see? There's a kind of glamour, there's a kind of menace. It's a kind of threat display, actually. You know, I've talked about the Charlotte Working in the context of threat display in the animal kingdom. At the end of the day, as I'm reflecting on it for you now, come to the conclusion that that's exactly what it was, and as such, it was entirely successful. But I'll get back to that point in a moment. So, the evil that operates in the human world is committed by other human creatures, by fiends and ghouls and psychotics and enemies of life and biophobic monsters. It's not an expression of supernatural evil coming out of the cosmos and reaching us through our own species. It's just human evil. And I'd say that we can agree that there's no way to overcome this evil that comes from our own species or from the archontically infected and deviated members of the human species, if you want to call them that, and that's pretty generous. There's no way to overcome it and work against it and hold it at bay without a deterrent. But a deterrent is meaningless. A deterrent is not a bluff. A deterrent is meaningless unless there is behind it the power and the skill to enforce that deterrent. So when you see animals in threat display, snarling at each other, whether they be domestic cats, domestic dogs, or whether they be animals in the wild, hyenas and lions, that's threat display. And very often the confrontation does not result in an actual engagement of violence. Very often it doesn't. But the threat display on both sides would not be effective if there were not the power and skill to back it up. And it's the same for us in the human kingdom. That is a great rule, a great moral or ethical rule taken from Gaian symbiosis. The deterrent must be backed up by a real capacity to act. Having said that, I must add that the capacity to act through violence and through the exertion of physical force in our world, in our domain, the human social order, the human kingdom, well, it's not given to everyone. And certainly everyone cannot take that responsibility. It is a responsibility undertaken by some members of the human community, no matter what that community may be. It may be a community of 600 people living somewhere in Montana, Oklahoma, or it may be a community of people living in Lower East Side, New York, downtown San Francisco. But it is a commitment of certain members of the community, and it is incorrect to expect that all members of the community can make that commitment, but those who are protected by those who make the commitment can give their respect and support to those who do. I've often said this. So I'm scrolling through the page of the unit here, and I'd like to start out in my reflection on the Charlotte Working by just reviewing for you how I got into it in the first place. So I felt instigated to undertake the Charlotte Working, you may recall, immediately upon completing the Gnostic investigation of the Mandela Effect in October of 2017. And at that time, there were two memes that were operating strongly in my life, and they came through in just about everything I put out back then. Command Performance and The Aeonic Mother Has Agency. And these two memes interplayed with each other. And so I felt compelled to deliver a command performance. Now, in a certain respect, the Mandela Effect decoded investigation is a command performance. What is the command performance? Well, in one respect, it is the demonstration that the Aeonic Mother has agency. You see, once she has agency, she needs her witnesses to reflect to her that she has it. She needs her witnesses to share the knowledge among themselves that she has agency, and then in some manner to act in a way that shows her that they know she has it. You could say, well, I did that, the Mandela Effect. I did that along with those of you who stayed with me through that exercise. Didn't do it by myself. You upheld it with me. And that was our command performance in response to the monumental event that the Aeonic Mother gained agency. So, what then can you make of the Charlotte Working that followed immediately upon that? Well, what happened in September and October as the Charlotte Working, as the Mandela Effect decoded sequence wound to its end, was that the internet was saturated with hype about this IT robot, Sophia, absolutely saturated. And I took that as a threat display on the part of the transhumanist Zadig, who want to convince us that robots and IT can become more intelligent than we are, and that eventually they will replace us either in a benevolent way by becoming our servants and leaving us with nothing to do, or they will be malevolent, they will act in a malevolent way, and they will just take over the world and wipe us out, which is a completely ludicrous fantasy that isn't worth an afternoon session of pretending with a 5-year-old child. You know, show me a robot who can do the laundry, sort, wash, resort, iron, put away clothing. Show me a robot who can fix the leak of the garden hose. The threat display of the transhumanist, I don't know what to call them, the transhumanist fanatics. Yeah, they are fanatics. People like Elon Musk. The threat display of those fanatics typically uses absurd exaggeration. They claim that robots are going to be able to do X, Y, and Z, but in fact, there is no robot that can even do A, B, or C. So how in the fuck are they going to get to X, Y, and Z? And it only takes a little common sense to sit back and say, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, if this is all true, and if the robotic sciences and the IT interactive Android type mechanisms like Sophia are going to be engineered to do what these fanatics claim, let's see them do something simple and elementary in the first place. That would be convincing. Build a robot that can fix the leak in the garden hose. Build a robot that can weed the garden intelligently. So I was fed up, pissed off, and triggered by all of that Sophia bullshit that was coming out of the internet at that time. And it so happens that one talk that I made in response to it got the most talk, by far the most talk of any talk I ever gave on that channel. It got something like 25,000 views due to the fact that I was addressing an issue which was trending at the moment. If you bear in mind the basic rule of realism regarding threat, then you have to say that the transhumanist fanatics, with all of the threats and fears that they're propagating about robotics and IT overtaking the human species, fails the test. There is no effective deterrent behind the claims that they're making. Can you see that? So their threat display, in my opinion, is a failure. Nevertheless, at that time, I felt compelled to answer the threat display exhibited through Sophia with a threat display of my own. And that is how the Charlotte Working came to be conceived. Now, I write here, note that point. The Charlotte Working was conceived as a threat display rather than an attack. That is true. And if you take away nothing else but that from this talk, you have my main point. However, in the process of constructing and implementing the lethal strike, I came at moments to the resolution that it was a lethal attack, and the objective of it was to produce a kill. So you see, those two objectives played in my mind, and there were times when I treated the Charlotte Working as if it were a lethal spell with the objective to kill. Now again, how does the Charlotte Working stand against that standard of threat? Well, in order for me to perform an open, transparent threat display of Gaian Tantric magic before the eyes of the world, I had to be certain that I could back it up. So you could say, can you see the beauty of this now, how this is unfolding? Yeah, it's taken me well over a year to get my mind clear on this. Beauty of it is that I constructed and implemented the ritual in the manner of an actual deterrent, in the manner of an actual effective killing spell, with that intention to prove that the threat display was valid. So the ritual was performed as a direct attack with a deliberate intention expressed openly and transparently to kill the TI. So scrolling down the unit page, there you see a typical collection of cords, nails, a plaque, cording knife, sinkers. These are the accessories required in order to perform a killing strike. So in the months that have passed, about, 18 months now, I guess. Yeah, getting around to 18 months since January of 2018, correct? 18, big number. 18 is also the cycle of the lunar nodes, 18.6. I get around to ask the question, well, what was the Charlotte working to her, to the Aeon Sophia, and was it a success from her viewpoint? So I'm beginning to think that it was. I'm beginning to think that from her viewpoint, the performance of the ritual in the way it was done, meticulously, was the result for her. It was the proof. And that being so, it did not require as proof the actual death of the TI by strangulation. Now, some people will certainly think that I'm making all this up as an elaborate rationalization to get myself off the hook. But I assure you, that's not at all the case. Charlotte Working was an act of Gaian tantric magic. That is to say, it was an act of a transcendental nature, a transcendental dynamic, and it can be understood from various angles, various approaches. But in one of those approaches, it must be seen in transcendental terms. So there is a transcendental significance and a lasting, enduring transcendental impact of the Charlotte Working, even though, as far as we know, and I'll get to this issue at the conclusion of this talk, even though it was not effective in bringing down the target. Now you see that I've taken the liberty to decorate this unit with some displays of the Day of the Dead theme. And I bring these up because they're obviously appropriate to the subject here, and they lead into the extremely crucial subject of Morbido. So let me talk a little bit for a moment about Morbido. Death is present in the natural world, but that's not Morbido. It's not Yuma Morbido, but it is her Morbido. Do you recall what the difference is between divine imagination and human imagination? Look again at the image of the bull in the constellations. Image of the bull represents, displays the power of divine imagination, which has always been associated with mother goddess figures, even though conventionally, you might think the bull is a male image, but no, the bull, and the more you go back and look at the image of the bull, you find that it relates closely to the powers of the Earth Mother, the Divine Mother. And the bull has two horns, which represent the two projective powers coming from the dreaming field of the Aeon Sophia, the libido, and the morbido. And when you look at the natural world, that's all you see. You see the libido, the power of reproduction. Typically, scholars refer to this, and they still do to this day, as, quote, fertility. So they talk about a fertility goddess. Well, the word is really misleading. It's not fertility. The libido is not fertility. The libido is an activity of divine imagination that produces species and produces all phenomena of nature. So the budding of trees, the growth of trees from small plants into trees, the flowering and the fruiting of trees, all that is libido. The propagation of schools of fish in the sea, of flocks of birds in the air, oh, this is her libido. And her libido is a material power. Likewise for her morbido. So everywhere in nature, apart from the human kingdom, let's step back and be spectators. What do we see? Everywhere you see the morbido. You see animals killing other animals. You see insects killing other insects. You see insects killing animals. You see snakes killing animals. You see animals killing snakes. However, that activity of her morbido, the materialization of her dreaming power in morbido, operates under very, very strict boundaries. And these phenomena, these events are obvious. You see them everywhere in the natural world. Characteristic of divine imagination is that in the same moment that the Aeon Sophia imagines something, it happens. There is no delay. There is not even a cause and effect. Divine imagination has the capacity to materialize instantaneously what is being imagined. So when you see the leaves of the trees budding in the springtime and the beautiful cherry blossoms come out and the plum blossoms, you're seeing before your eyes the materializing power of the Aeonic Mother. And then when you see those trees fade, the leaves fade, the cherries ripen and then they die and they fall off the tree and they rot in the ground and the leaves of the tree turn color and fall off, you're seeing her morbido in its immediacy. It's not a cause and effect process. It happens materially as she dreams it. So what is the difference between divine imagination and human imagination? Well, human imagination normally can't do that. For human beings to materialize something they imagine requires sometimes a very elaborate process. To build a house, to build a dollhouse, to build a birdhouse. When you imagine a birdhouse, you imagine the shape of it, you imagine the birds you want to come to it, you imagine where you're going to hang it in the tree, and you imagine all those things, and then you go and you undertake the course of action to achieve them. That's human imagination. You can't just sit on your back patio and imagine a birdhouse in that tree over there and then the birdhouse materializes in the tree, can you? No. So that's the difference. And it's that difference is crucial to these reflections on the Charlotte working. When you turn away from the morbido of the Mother Goddess and you look for the morbido In the human animal, then you enter a field of deep investigation. Now, as I've shown here by these glamorous and in some respects, if you might say, sinister images, what I've shown is that there is a mystique of morbido in the human consciousness, and it shows up in some cultures more than others. You could say that the samurai cult of Japan, with the rite of seppuku, or suicide of the samurai, is a mystique of libido. The Aztecs had a mystique of libido in the ritual wars that they undertook. And the one place today where I would say, without question, you find the mystique of morbido, human morbido, acted out and displayed most lavishly is certainly in Mexico. So as I write there, in the visceral knowledge of indigenous peoples, presence of death is not merely an event, but an agency, an active force having the character of an entity. She is usually pictured as a she. There are some of her names: White Lady, Black Lady, Nuestra Señora de la Santa Muerte, Our Lady of Holy Death. And she is actually a folk saint in Latino Mexican-American culture. That is a very great fact. And devotees do not see her as something evil, but rather they see her as the personification of death, which is inevitable, but they see her as associated with healing powers and the protection of life and safe passage into the afterlife. On the other hand, the same mystique of morbido takes a very, very evil turn in that particular country. And the evidence of that evil distortion of the morbido can be seen in the cult of death that is embraced and propagated by the cartels and prison gangs and M13. And those groups consist exclusively of males who have set up as an idol or icon the male figure of Señor Muerte, and that figure mirrors to them their enactment of morbido. But their enactment of morbido is a toxic morbido. It's not a morbido engaged by human animals in the cause of life and in the protection of life. It's engaged in an insane and sadistic celebration of the power to kill. So there's no doubt that you can look around, and I could give other examples. It's a fascinating topic for investigation. There's no doubt that the mystique of morbido is there, but all of that begs the question, well, where is the sane morbido of the human male and female? By the way, it's not an exclusive possession of the male, not by a long shot. But where is that operating? When is it going to emerge? When and how and where is there going to be proof that some human animals take responsibility for the implementation of the morbido, which means, in plain English, the activation of the force behind the deterrent? If you stand in front of someone and you threaten to kill them, well, you better be able to do it. You better have the capacity to kill, otherwise it's an empty threat. So the threat has to be real. And the human implementation of the morbido has to be grounded in reality. It has to be sane and, what shall I say, testable and provable. How about that? When you put it in the framework of human life, in human social relations, then you'll find that the application of the morbido is pretty clear cut regarding, you know, the necessity to apply morbido is pretty clear cut. So Calica knows that you apply morbido principally in two circumstances. One is to protect, and the other is for revenge. And that basically sums it up. And if you go and you look at classical stories, well-done stories, that have not been distorted by the Zenosh, well, you'll find that message is pretty clear. For instance, if you go and watch The Virgin Spring by Ingmar Bergman, and I certainly recommend you watch that film, you'll see that the father in the film takes revenge. He exercises his morbido on those who raped and killed his daughter. And the manner in which he does it is brilliant. If you look at the way it's filmed, look at the way Bergman directed it, look at the way Max von Sydow acted it, there's no gloating. There's no sadistic grinning and gloating in his exercise of the morbido. It's dispassionate. It's clear and clean. So this is something to bear in mind, and that there is a standard for among Calicas for the exercise of morbido. I would be remiss if I didn't point that out. So halfway through this talk, I'm going to get off this subject of the morbido. I know it's not palatable to some people. And I can tell you it's really not palatable to me either. I do my best to talk about it in a sane and balanced way, but there is something unpalatable about it. Why is that? Well, quite simply because it's against human nature to kill our own kind. But it's necessary to do so, and has been necessary to do so, and always will be. Then again, Calica must make a very clear distinction between those of our own kind who are goyim, that is to say, dangerous and insane human animals that need to be put down, and the parasitical deviants. And I pointed out that distinction in the talks on contraviolence, where I corrected my initial statements. So taking out the Zenosh is not the same as taking out a non-Zenosh. If you kill a parasite in your body or eliminate a parasite in your body, that's not the same as going out and killing a deer to eat for survival, or killing someone who comes into your boundaries and threatens you and your family and your community. These are not the same. And these differences are matters to be discussed carefully and rigorously among all of us who take this challenge to heart. Whether or not you are willing, whether or not you are one of those who takes responsibility for the action, there is a responsibility in discussing that action. I'd like to add, as a final remark, before I run down the timeline of the Charlotte Working, I'd like to speak heart to heart in frontal honesty to anyone who has difficulty with this topic. If you have the tendency to be a pacifist, if you have felt all through your life the importance of nonviolence, not committing violence, I totally empathize with you. Believe me, I do not discard or discount those considerations. I just want to say this to you. You might have to go through some kind of emotional breakdown to come to terms with this subject, the human application of morbido. And you might have to weep and wail and cry. In the process of surrendering that pacifist feeling. It's a feeling, and you identify it as a moral feeling. Oh, I could never do that. I could never support that. I could never bear letting that happen. When you surrender that pacifist block, call up before you, call up in your mind, right in front of you, the image of those great predatory cats with teardrop markings. They have the teardrop markings to show you that they carry your grief, the grief that naturally arises from the depth of your soul when you realize that pacifism is not an option anymore. So on that note, I'll return to the unit here and scan down. There you see the first photograph shows my hand reaching out to indicate where the third nail was rigged on that slanting line just above shoulder level. And I'll see to it when this unit is release that there are some other photos from the site that help you picture what it actually looks like. So first of all, just very quickly, as I already noted, there were events that occurred in 2017 from October onward that were preparatory to the ritual, and there they are. So on the first, there was the Las Vegas shooting, which was a decisive event, concluding the Mandela effect or the correction effect in its first phase. And then, a little over a month later, I received the name of the TI on Charlotte's Ridge, and I also saw or realized the full command syntax, C:\kill, followed by the command syntax. So I knew exactly how the ritual was to be performed. Then there were various signs and omens, Venus and Jupiter conjunct Kambalia, Saturn at the galactic center. It only happens once every 28 years. And the complete reversal of the moon's nodes at the end of November from the position that they held in August of 2008 when I received the terma. So then we run smack into 2018, and the sequence of events from January 1st onward was extremely tight and extremely intense. And I can say that once the resolution had been made to perform the Charlotte working, the TI had been identified and so forth, that I myself and the primary witness, we found ourselves in the thrall of that magic. And every moment of every day was vivid, absolutely vivid. And the spell was upon us, even in the act of preparing the spell, you see. So I've listed there some of the conditions and omens in the celestial writing. The wolf moon of January 1st of that year, the supermoon due to the lunar perigee in Capricorn, close to Nunki, the star that marks the vein of the archer's arrow, and the beginning of the lunar increment on January 13th. And so I did perform the Charlotte working during the lunar increment. So then you see the specific and exact moments of the ritual with the indications that I followed every single aspect, every meticulous detail of the ritual was reflected in some way in the events that were happening in the sky. On January 14th, Mars was in Scorpio, which is in the scales, and Jupiter was at the fulcrum of the scales, you see. Jupiter is at the fulcrum of the scales when the Charlotte working was performed. So those of you who are familiar with these notations will see that the support and interactivity coming from the cosmos was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And when you find yourself in a moment like that, where the cosmic display of Sophia's dreaming power is transmitting to you these through these powerful omens, one after another, one omen overlapping and leading into the other, well, then you are in the thrall of that magic. You are already an instrument of that magic. It is working on you as you undertake to work it. And those were some really intense days, I can assure you. Also, I took a photograph on the morning of January 15th, which I don't have, unfortunately, because a couple of days later, I lost the computer that had that photo in it. But I can reproduce that moment on Stellarium, and I will do that, and I will do a screenshot of it, because that view of what I saw at that moment was, in a way, the key. I had the key and the confirmation from the interactivity of the sky writing that this ritual was right on the mark. And then on that same day, in the afternoon, I had the lucid dream of the griffin, which I strangled, the griffin, which was a sort of a fox-like creature with wings. And I received the Kurukula intel on the totemic animal of the TI. It doesn't get any better than that. And then on the 16th again, I undertook with the primary witness and collaborator, undertook to re-rig the strike. And at that moment, the sinker fell when we were standing outside of the rigging with the SC app, and it left the nail hanging in the drawing cord. So the second nail, first nail was never found, okay? Second nail hung in the drawing cord. We call that the hangman nail. So then the ritual went on. It wasn't by any means over at that point. The Kurukula shift ended on the 16th. The lunar increment ended on the 16th. And then we went into the Kali shift on the 17th of January. And so I've also listed there some accessory events that happened around the time, during the time of the ritual. There were mandala effects of the dark side of the moon, which was a reference to the lunar increment, and the new moon leading to the Kali shift, you see. The ritual was performed in the dark of the moon. My pet goat is a reference to Kali, to the goldfish, the constellation of the goldfish, which is the display of Mahakali. There were 4chan posts discussing attacks on the TI. There was a petition that circulated openly on the internet against the writings of the TI. There were death rumors circulating about the TI. All this happened simultaneously with the performance of the ritual. A silex arrowhead was discovered in Andalusia at Valencina de la Concepcion, not far from Infinity Ridge. And at that moment, there was a triangle of the silex star, Spora, and Mars and Jupiter in the sky. Triangular formations in the sky can be read as confirmations that you are tracking the activity of the wisdom goddess, because it's known that the goddess operates in threes, and 3 times 3 in 9 and 18, 3, 9, and 18. So when you find those numbers come up, you know that you are conducting the ritual in the correct manner. So turning now to the timeline, there were 2 super moons in that year, and the ritual was conducted exactly at the midpoint of those 2. You see the beauty of that? So there was again a super blue blood moon eclipse on January 31st. And then we move into February. And on February 12th, you have the discovery of a dead fox on the track leading to the cording for the Charlotte working. And the hangman nail was still in the rigging. February 13th, I returned, and that was also when the Parkland shooting occurred, or February 14th, I believe it was. In any case, immediately after that, the Kali shift ended, and the Matangi shift began. And then on February 16th, which happens to be the birthday of Jan Kerouac, that is when I walked to the site, and I had it in the back of my mind, I must take a camera because we must photograph the hangman's nail, which we never did. And then I found that the hangman nail had gone and the sinker line had dropped. So time goes on. We're moving into March, still living in the mystery of these events, knowing, you know, the 2 primary witnesses here on site, knowing that this wasn't over yet, the feeling that we were still in the compulsion and orchestration of something supernatural was extremely strong. And so on Friday the 16th of March, V alone took a walk and had in the back of her mind the floating thought, well, something is going to be different. And that's when she found the third rigging with the third nail. Came back and told me Friday afternoon, and the next day we went and confirmed it together, and we photographed the third nail. We also found black cord on the ground, which is unheard of. It's impossible that the Nawal, in performing that rite, the Nawal and his apprentice, would have left black cord on the ground. It's just, the only black cord you bring to such a ritual is the drawing cord that you integrate into the cording. But there was black cord on the ground. And it was knotted into the loop of a drawing cord. But when I picked it up and I looped it over my thumb and drew it back to my jaw, it proved to be considerably longer than the line from my thumb to my jaw. So it was a drawing cord that had been designed to the proportion of someone who was, you know, at least a half a size, again, larger than me, taller than me, with longer arms. And so shortly after that, the Matangi shift ended and the Swandeva shift began. And then a couple of days later, the apprentice returned to the cording and found that the third nail had been triggered. And after much effort, she was able to find that nail on the ground. And so we have the third nail. It landed in close proximity to the sinker. The drawing cord was still hung in the cording. And we have a photographic record of all those details. So to conclude my talk in this unit, I just want to remind you of one very great fact, and then I'll give you my final reflections on why the Charlotte Working played out in the way it did. You may recall, if you go back to the beginning of the Gnostic investigation of the Mandela effect, that I established the first supercluster on the basis of two effects, the VW emblem and the Ford emblem. And I argued that these two effects were exemplary of an actual material change of substance. So how could the VW emblem have had no separation between the upper V and the lower W, and then it had separation? How could the Ford insignia imprinted on engine blocks have no pigtail, and there is residual evidence of that, and then how could it now have the pigtail in the signature, in the line that crosses the F? How could this be? Well, I said that that is proof that the Aeonic Mother has agency, and through her agency, she can actually affect material change. And isn't that exactly what she did by producing the third nail? See, the third nail is the confirmation of everything that led to the Charlotte Working. The third nail is her response to the Charlotte Working. The third nail is her way to say, you don't have to believe John Lash when he talks about the instantaneous materializing power of divine imagination. And you don't have to believe him when he claims that human animals can use Gayan tantric magic to call upon the supernatural power of the Aeonic Mother. You don't have to believe it, any of it. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of fact. And here is the proof. So that's how I regard it to this day, at this moment, 18 months later. That's how I regard the outcome of the Charlotte Working. And having come to that conclusion, I also realized something else. Having come to the conclusion that the ritual was proven by the third nail, I am able to go back and look at what would have happened had it been otherwise, you see? Had it been otherwise. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, suppose that I had succeeded with terminating the TI. If I had succeeded in terminating the TI, if the killing spell had actually produced that effect, well, how would you know? And how would it have played out? Well, I can see two ways that it would have played out. In the first place, it could have played out in this way. The fact of the death of the TI would never be publicly known. It would never be allowed to be known. especially if those around that individual in the security mechanism, which is enormous, and bear in mind also that the whole series of those books is a production of MI5, and that the author is an MI5 asset. Well, don't you think that MI5 will keep a close eye on his asset if they picked up on the internet any rumors that there was a killing spell directed against her? Well, they would certainly have paid attention to that. And if something had happened to her that confirmed that the killing spell was real, was effective, they would never, ever, ever let it be known publicly. Can you see that? So you have to face the possibility that it could have played out in this way. It's possible that it did happen, but that it was concealed. It did achieve its objective, but it was never allowed, that objective was never allowed to become a matter of public knowledge, and you can see why. Now turn around and look at how it would have played out in another way if it had become public knowledge. Let's say that the news went out on the alternative internet, coming out through 4chan or whatever, coming out through alternative channels. Bear in mind that that entire ritual was performed openly and transparently in the public eye. Although the name of the TI was not stated, it wasn't difficult with the riddles provided to figure out who it was. And suppose that it had succeeded and that the knowledge of the ritual that produced that result had become public knowledge. How would that have played out? What position would that have put me in? Now, I have to tell you that in my arrogance and in my grandiosity and inflation, which is a typical risk of the Nahual, I was willing to be the public figure who was identified as the source of that ritual and therefore as the agent who would have produced the death of that individual. I was willing to do that. You see, I was going to back it up with my life. Well, I don't think it's such a stretch to speculate here, and all we can do is speculate. But do you think it would have been in the best interest of the Aeon Sophia herself for me to be in that position? I mean, what would have happened to me? What would have happened to my life? What would have happened to the attention I drew? Well, I would have been, you might say, in a unique position of power, and I would have been able to maybe publicly say, okay, I proved I can do this, and now I'm going to do it to so-and-so, and what do you make of that? And name openly someone. Can you imagine the panic and the mayhem that would have been created if it played out in that way? I was open to it playing out in that way, but it didn't. So obviously, I have been spared the consequences. And at the same time, I have, and you have, a confirmation that could only have come from a supernatural intervention. And there the matter stands, and will always stand, and will always endure. The Charlotte Working. The first and everlasting proof of Gayan Tantric magic.